struts like John Wayne, resembles Jim Carrey, and dresses like he's visually impaired. Because he is. Insight with Mark Farrell on the Progressive Radio Network.
Yes, 11 o'clock in New York City, the Big Apple. Hope you're doing well on this Thursday, the first full official day of spring. So no matter where you're listening in the States, hopefully you have the luxury of enjoying free ice cream from Dairy Queen and Italian ices from Rita's or something similar, which is always kind of a fun thing to do on the first day of spring because our kids always remind us of this, right? We got to go get that free ice cream or those Italian ices. That's kind of fun. Nice way to do that. And also, the birds are back. You know, Mother Nature doesn't lie. If the birds are here, that means spring is here. Have an excellent show for you. Going to meet Kristen Curley. She is going to be sleeping on the streets in New Jersey for Covenant House, so homelessness can be reduced and or banished altogether. We're going to meet the author of an incredible new book, The Power of Sports, Media, and Spectacle in American Culture. Author Michael Serrazio is going to be joining us in a few minutes. And, of course, we always welcome your calls, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. My name is Mark Farrell. Thank you so much for joining me today and every Thursday. Love doing the show with you guys. And love your emails, mark@markfarrellmotivation.com, mark@markfarrellmotivation.com. So something hit the news yesterday, which is pretty abysmal, but yet actually not that surprising. In Seoul, Korea, all the hotels and thousands of people that were subjected to hidden cameras, unbeknownst to them, that were being live streamed. Can you imagine this? Most of the cameras were in bathrooms and some of them in the main portion of the hotel room where you sleep and stay and change. And this is not the first occurrence. So people are flipping out. And this motel chain apparently is not aware that this was taking place. And the funniest part, which is not kind of funny, but hey, it's a business model, right? They were charging people like $50 a month for this live stream service. Can you imagine this? I mean, this is what the world has come to. This is the world we live in where people, number one, think of this concept. You know, let's go into hotel rooms, put very small cameras, and not only are we going to record it for people to play back when we have a subscription service, but they can watch it live. So I just can't imagine, and we're not going to go into detail, but use your crazy, vivid imagination about what goes on in the bathroom. Things that you don't even want to see yourself doing, let alone others doing, right? And there's a market for this? I mean, crazy. I just don't get it. Yes, do I want to see a beautiful woman on the pages of a glossy magazine? Yes. Do I want to and or possibly take the chance of exploring watching a beautiful woman in the bathroom? No, thank you. And especially if it's something that is in violation of their privacy. So many laws are broken. I just can't wrap my head around it. Hey, I understand people can do their own things behind closed doors, and that's great. That's what privacy is all about. But when people are subjected to thinking they're going to get a good night's rest or a vacation, and yet, you know, I'm sure there are minors involved because, you know, they can't obviously control the people going into the room, especially if the hotel's not involved, especially when the platform and the sheer magnitude of numbers of people who were going to stay there, the guests that were being part of this whole scam. You know, yeah, I'm sure minors were in this because, and I'm sure they didn't turn the cameras off because I'm sure there's a whole different audience for that, which is completely disgusting. And yeah, hard to even wrap my head around that aspect. But anyway, this is not the first time this has happened in Seoul. And I am sure as we speak, there are places in the United States and wherever you are based thinking, uh-oh, we better do a better job of doing a clandestine placement of our cameras. We need to hide them better. So the first thing I usually do, like most people, when you go into a hotel room, no matter how nice it is, you fold down, or a hotel room, you fold down the comforter because you never know what takes place on top of that because, yeah, again, use your imagination. So now the other thing is you're going to have to go get some hotel towels and place them over the cable box or parts of the bathroom like a soap dispenser or anything that you feel that will potentially have a camera in it. I mean, people are going to be so paranoid. My wife even said to me this morning, I'm going to get one of those RF things. I said, what are you talking about? This is before she articulated what she was talking about in terms of the story. I was like, what do you want a scrambler for? She's like, oh, I'm sorry. Here's why. And we're about to go on vacation in a couple of weeks. And she was telling me, I'm like, oh, all right. Well, I don't think that's really going to work. But yeah, we'll go along with it. But I guess you have to do your diligence in terms of checking out a hotel room. My God, this is crazy stuff. Robert Kraft, you know, he was busted for solicitation a couple of weeks ago. this multi-millionaire, actually, I think he's close to being a billionaire. And the funniest thing for me is that he doesn't have this procured. Yes, it's illegal in most states of the country. It's the oldest industry out there. Is it ever going to cease from happening? No, of course not. But I can't believe someone of his caliber and stature, which of course, you know, money doesn't equate class. We know that. But he's not smart enough to realize that he should not get caught in the limelight of a sexual scandal, prostitution, solicitation, because of who he leads, the New England Patriots and being part of the NFL, etc. But no, that's not the way he was thinking and went to a very, very low-end place where he got busted. But anyway, so apparently a plea deal is on the table. And I want to ask our guest when we get him on the phone in a few minutes, because obviously he's an expert in the sports area in terms of marketing, media, the conglomeration that just swallows up America and it's all its fans, to find out his take on this. Because if he takes the plea deal, that means he obviously pleads guilty. And then that means Robert Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, will have to sanction him a little bit more arduously, more difficult-wise, severe sanctions, I should say, than if he doesn't plead guilty. So that'll be an interesting aspect. But the reality is, I still can't believe that he got caught doing something so dumb, really dumb, because, I'm surprised he doesn't have a right arm man who just says, okay, Mr. Kraft, your guest is waiting for you in hotel room number 682 in a posh hotel where, you know, it's very hush hush and your money's exchanged behind closed doors. He never even sees the money. He just goes in there, knows nothing about it, and et cetera, et cetera. Especially since this guy, you know, is old and wrinkly and looks like a raisin or a grape. Hey, I'm not trying to be an ageist, but the reality is he's not going to be getting 20-year-olds. But then again, I'm sure there are 20-year-olds out there who want a gold digger, who want to be a gold digger, who want the, what's the expression when you have the husband or who's the breadwinner, not gold digger. Anyway, I forget what it's called. But it's interesting material out there because in an era where we're looking to legalize marijuana, it's going back and forth in the state of New Jersey. Medicinal uses, of course, has passed. What they did pass the other day was a rain tax, which I don't really know enough about to profess, but I will say that it seems like it's going to get a lot of pushback. A lot of towns and a lot of residents are up in arms across New Jersey, the highest paying property tax state in the United States, and they're adding yet more taxes on there, saying that rainwater going into the sewers, the cost of maintenance, etc., is weighing on towns and local municipalities. But how many different towns and municipalities out there are probably going to decline it? Probably not any. As the town that I live in is not an affluent town, but it's very, very big, and they charge a lot of taxes. I pay, fair amount of money for my property. And there are homes around the corner from me that are brand new homes that start at $750,000 and their taxes start at $38,000. That's for the most basic home. $38,000 just for taxes, property taxes. And they do not have sewer services or water. They have to pay for septic and well. So they're not even getting much for their money. Anyway, I can do a whole show on that as well. So I'm looking forward to speaking to Kirsten Corley, who's a devout employee to the Covenant House in about 25 minutes or so, and what she's doing to change homelessness in New Jersey. This woman is such a person who has a heart for everyone out there in the world, who just is such a philanthropist, someone who cares deeply about human nature, about human beings, the course of life, the trajectory for making a better opportunities for people out there across the board. And we're going to hear from her, and again, in just a few minutes, because she's going to be sleeping out in the streets of Newark, New Jersey. Newark, most people think it's the capital of New Jersey, but Trenton is. And it has some interesting parts, to say the least. But I'm sure it's going to be a safe and protected area. But nonetheless, you imagine getting a sleeping bag and or a box, and people would say, okay, have a great night's slumber. I mean, you're not really going to sleep out. Actually, I remember sleeping in a homeless shelter. Wow, this was a while ago. In New York City, probably about 15 years ago. And I don't remember the name of the organization. But what I did was I volunteered and I served dinner to the residents who would come in. I think there was probably 20 or 30 people who slept in a shelter. And then we would clean up. We would have banter, conversation with the individuals. And then at a certain time, it's kind of like lights out. And we would go into the kitchen, myself and the gentleman who was the organizer who ran this homeless shelter. And we basically locked ourselves in the kitchen. We pulled out two cots. Was it bizarre? It felt extremely bizarre. But I'm thinking to myself, hey, I'm doing this for one night. I'm trying to do a great deed here and open my eyes up. Actually, I did a radio special on it. I did a show and interviewed some of the homeless persons and find out, you know, what brought them there. A lot of them had mental illness, et cetera, which is very, very popular. But the interesting aspect was, you know, one night, you know, I hardly slept. I think I probably shut my eyes for maybe an hour or two. But it was so bizarre to see their lifestyle, such a tumultuous lifestyle where lights went on, I don't know, I'll say 6:30, 7 a.m., breakfast was served, and they had to leave. And that shelter became something else throughout the day. And that's when I would leave and showered up and went to work and worked on putting together this special. But it's a great experience that everyone should do. And very quickly, I said to my son and daughter recently the other day, because when they said throw it away, what's away? Where's away? I said, great question, because when I was in college, I did a bevy of jobs. One of them was being a garbage collector for about 3 weeks. And that's a long story, and I'll tell you about that later. But the reality is once or twice, I actually went with the truck when it went to the dump to empty, excuse me, its contents. And this, I can picture this like I was there yesterday. It was the most eye-opening experience. Scary, sad, frightening experience of my life. We're in this truck, and I remember just going through these gates that you couldn't see anything through. Of course, you could smell the garbage wafting through the air everywhere. And all I saw for as far and long as the eye could see was trash, completely flat. It almost looked like a shag carpet with just colors popping everywhere. And countless, you know, as far as the eye could see, pigeons, birds, you name it. And the truck would just drive, drive, and drive, and drive, and drive. I couldn't tell you, because it was hard to measure the distance because you were going slow and it's garbage, and I was in complete awe. And you get to this one area where it almost looked like a spaceship landed, where it was a concave area, where that's where they were actually filling in the land that day with that particular trash in that area. And there are bulldozers, huge earth movers, just piling and pushing and moving the trash. And I was like, whoa, this is reality. This is sad. This is where it all goes. And that's 15 years ago. There was actually a great article in the Times the other day about a whale, a very sad story, about, I'm not sure if it was a whale was beached, but they did an autopsy on this whale and did looked at all the contents in this whale's stomach, and the amount of plastic that was in the whale was just, you know, mind-boggling. Very, very sad stuff. Anyway, so next time you go to throw something away, think about its life, its shelf life. Can someone else use it? Can you recycle it? But the more I read about recycling, you know, just try to give it another life. It's Mark Farrell on the Progressive Radio Network. The show is Insight. Thank you so much for joining me. Michael Sarazio, is an incredible author, faculty member of the Department of Communication at Boston College, incredible college, award-winning former journalist. He writes for both scholarly and popular publications, and he's the author of Your Ad Here, The Cool Sell of Guerrilla Marketing, and it's my pleasure to welcome him to the show. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Thanks very much for having me.
How's the weather today in Boston, my friend?
It's getting better. We're starting to see some of the buds come out on trees, and, you know, we're sort of inching towards spring.
You guys kind of had a brutal winter so far.
Every winter's a brutal winter here in Boston.
That's true.
I'm a native San Diegan, so I'm not built for it.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess education brought you there, correct?
More or less, yeah.
So, Michael, my first question for you, fans. Are fans really the driving force behind this, like, this gargantuan machine we call sports, and they just get gobbled up in this cycle, and they don't even realize it?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the pervasive and profound facts of our sports culture in America, and globally for that matter, is just how it has ballooned in slow motion over the past several decades. You know, statistics alone, the global sports industry is pegged somewhere between $200 billion and $700 billion, depending on how you want to calculate it.
Wow.
The sheer amount of outlets, the sheer amount of information, the sheer amount of media time and sort of cultural focus that is given over to sports is pretty exceptional. And to this point, there has yet to be really a burst in the sports bubble, even amidst the Great Recession of 10 years ago, when more or less all industries, market sectors were sort of falling to the floor. Sports continued to chug along with steady growth year over year, better than many nations' GDPs at that time. I think it is a gargantuan spectacle. It is driven by fan interest. It is driven by, media opportunity and media ambition. And I don't see it slowing down anytime soon.
And amid all the scandals, it seemed the numbers for the NFL dwindled a little bit. But this year actually looked like they were back on the rise.
Yeah, they did. They bounced back after a couple of years of being off in terms of ratings. And, you know, the funny thing is you know, there's been 1,000 diagnoses of what it was that caused some of the NFL's ratings to be flat for a couple of years. And certainly the politicization of Colin Kaepernick and the Black Lives Matter movement played into some of that in terms of diagnosing why it would have been the NFL was off. There were other possibilities. The celebrity players, star players were not, were injured, were not being featured prominently in marquee matchups. The sense that perhaps the NFL had spread its product too wide, just there's too many nights that it's on, there's too many games available, and so it diluted and diminished the quality of the product. I don't think we'll ever know why it was the NFL had an off couple of years. I think it's a space where there's plenty of opportunity for folks to sort of pitch their theories depending on their political, biases or business
sure.
biases. But we simply cannot know. It was not something we'll be able to know what the sort of cause and effect. But yeah, as you identify, it has bounced back a little bit this season. And I think, Roger Goodell has publicly stated that he hopes to get the league to $25 billion in annual revenues by middle of next decade. And, you know, it certainly seems plausible at this point.
And, Michael, I think the proliferation of all the digital platforms and the timing could all simply just come down to that, because people are exploring different ways to watch TV, live streaming, et cetera, so many different options. And of course, with the CTE and of course, all the high profile players being arrested, it may have just been a coincidental timing issue as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And what you speak to in terms of how we're consuming sports differently nowadays is probably the biggest existential question for the sports media industry. More or less for decades, growth, revenues, and really the sort of institutional identity of sports media has been based upon people getting their sports through the cable package. You get it sort of in traditional forms via broadcast and cable TV.
Mm-hmm.
And that is simply not the way that younger audiences are consuming. There are different sort of figures on it, but I've seen a lot of references to maybe somewhere between a third and a quarter of millennials, you know, folks in their 20s and younger, simply do not have a cable subscription. And so the real kind of crisis moment for, I think, a lot of these leagues is to figure out how is it that you're going to continue to serve these populations and make revenues off them if they're no longer consuming sports content from the traditional televised platforms that they've always been.
Do you think the allegiance with millennials is as strong as it is with persons, viewers in their 30s, 40s, and 50s? Michael? All right, Michael, we're going to see if we can get you back on the call here. If you're listening, we may want to try a different landline, or if that's a cell phone, we should try a different landline. Anyway, it's very interesting impactful statement in terms of commitment. I know millennials have different ways of viewing, as we were talking about, and the reality is they just consume information differently. But, I mean, a sports fan is a sports fan. Sorry, Michael, welcome back.
Yeah, I apologize for that. I don't know if that's
okay
here in the office or whatever. But yeah, so there's a big debate about whether or not millennials, you know, take to sports with passion and intensity that older generations do. Some make the case that they're not as big fans, that they're actually some people think that esports, electronic sports, is carving into some of that market. Some think that other, you know, MMA, UFC type sports are cannibalizing that market. You know, so it's a real question going forward. And then the other thing is whether or not millennials are disposed to sit for 4 hours at a time to consume a continuous content stream.
It's a big commitment.
Yeah, it's a big commitment, and this is a group that I think has been sort of weaned on snippet-driven, you know, YouTube-length, shorter information content, and to say, hey, you know, can you sit down for 160 times a year to watch a three-hour, four-hour-long baseball game with, you know, tons of stops and starts? That's going to be a tough existential sell for baseball in particular, but for sports as a whole.
And that goes into one of your points in terms of the media aspect, in terms of making this palette size. ESPN is very, very good about this in terms of the sports highlights, packaging things so small and so quickly and swiftly that you can get your fix, you can get caught up to speed. So why lose 2 or 3 hours of your life?
Yeah, exactly. And this also goes to another sort of existential crisis, which is what's the point of a highlight show nowadays? If people can get those highlights at any time, at any place on their phones, what is the point of non-game content that shows up in sports media? And really the answer that's been provided is a similar answer to what we've seen in the news business broadly, which is the rise of what I call the hot take industrial complex. More or less, this is a shift within sports media, but we certainly see it in broader news media as well, away from reporting, away from the dictates of objectivity, and toward embracing debate, embracing opinion-oriented content, embracing saying things that are outrageous, that will get clicks, that will go viral. And again, this is not unique to sports media, but
sure,
sports media is thrown in deep with it for sure.
It's kind of a sad state of existence right now. And as a writer, as a professor of communication at Boston College, how do you think sports journalism is surviving and or reflecting of the actual sport and or overall umbrella of reporting honestly with, what's the word I'm looking for? Accuracy, I should say.
Yeah. You know, some question... I think provocatively whether sports journalism can even be a thing, for a couple of reasons. First off, when you talk about sports journalism in a broadcasting context, you're talking about institutions like ESPN that shell out billions of dollars to be able to broadcast the same content that they then turn around and try to cover objectively. It's not just the sort of economic incentives here. It's not in ESPN's interest to damage the NFL, to damage the NBA, when they've paid, you know, billions of dollars to be able to have the rights to show those games. So there's, you know, in the broadcasting realm of both radio and TV, there's an inherent conflict of interest, and there always has been. And it's true of print as well. Print sports journalism, newspapers are heavily dependent on the teams that they cover. And now they're also competing with the teams they cover because, you know, you you can find out information about the Yankees by reading the New York Daily News, or you can just go to Yankees.com, and that's a competitor. So more or less every team nowadays, every media outlet is competing with the teams they cover, as well as being complicit in terms of the rights deals. But it also, speaks to another problem, which is that, do we want sports journalists to be like the journalism that we consume in other realms? Do we want hard-hitting, investigative sports journalism?
Absolutely.
I understand why you would want that in the realm of political issues and business malfeasance, things like that. But there's something about sports that entices people with a sort of, it's entertainment, it's mm-hmm. escapism, don't
exactly.
take it seriously. And I think that also seduces journalists and the media away from covering it in an aggressive, investigative way.
Michael Serrazio, the point you just made is interesting, as well as in terms of a corporation like ESPN, how objective can they be in slamming like the NFL, et cetera, when it's kind of like biting the hand that that's feeding them?
Yeah, and this was most famously borne out in the documentary League of Denial that more or less kicked off, I think, a lot of the concussion crisis coverage and sort of that being an issue at the center of sports culture. ESPN was initially involved in that documentary, but then dropped out at some point, presumably at the behest of the NFL. That's sort of the most prominent example, but on a day-to-day level, in talking with folks at the network and folks in sports media, there's a sense that, to give you one example, Linda Cohn, who's a fantastic anchor at ESPN and also just a diehard hockey fan, more or less told me that, ESPN doesn't have any incentive to cover the NHL because that's a contract that NBC has. So it's not only in terms of not aggressively covering the teams and leagues that media have rights with, it's also ignoring or marginalizing the teams and leagues that they don't have any reason to push because it'll push it to a competitor. And this is true, I think, most prominently when it comes to the lack of coverage of women's sports as well.
Sure. I mean, that can be applied to most industries because it's kind of ignore unless you come on our side, and then we'll promote you and we'll partner up.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what about women in journalism and women in sports? Obviously, it's a very vital time. In the last year and a half, Me Too movement, it's never been more apparent in terms of the actual numbers, the very sizable and very small numbers. As a matter of fact, I find it kind of funny on the NFL coverage in terms of let's go live down to the field too. And I don't know the women reporters well enough to say, go to Barbara. And I mean, she gets, and I understand it's a game, but I mean, she'll get 5 seconds, 7 seconds. It almost looks like it's pre-recorded because it goes to it so quickly and so succinctly that it almost seems like they are doing this because they have to.
Yeah, exactly. So it really is astonishing how far we haven't come with regard to opportunity for women to take part in sports media. Let me give you a couple of statistics here that are a bit dated, but still relatively reflected. 95% of sports anchors are men. 99% of sports commentators are men. 91% of sports page editors are men. You did not have until the last couple of years, for the first time ever, you had a female Monday Night Football commentator, Beth Mowins. For the first time ever, you've had a regular NBA color analyst who's female, Doris Burke. And generally speaking, the experience these women have is one of being insulted, being marginalized, being abused, being stalked outright in the case of Aaron Andrews. And Twitter is really the space for the most sort of vile harassment that they tend to experience. They're also, I think, put, according to my interviewees for this book, they're put in the unfortunate position of having to look good in a way that male sports media members are not. But by virtue of looking good, they feel as though that calls into question their credibility. And so they feel a real acute pressure and double bind to both strike that appearance that will get them the job, but then also the fact of that appearance often being attractive in a conventional way winds up challenging what they feel like could be their credibility with audience members.
Absolutely. And the same low numbers can be applied to the actual NFL teams. Actually, I believe yesterday, two women were announced to be a strength and conditioning coach and maybe an assistant coach at another level. And I forget the team. I think it's a West Coast football team. Are you familiar with that, Michael?
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds familiar. Yeah. You're seeing a few breakthroughs here and there. You're seeing a few, a few roles being offered at the ranks of management, the ranks of coaching, things like that. But by and large, that reflects an experience that we see of female sports media figures and also female athletics itself. For decades, research has shown that most sports media devotes no more than 3 to 5% of its time to women's athletics. That's been a really consistent finding over the decades, that on average nationally, ESPN, when it comes to local sports broadcasts on local TV networks, you won't find more than 5% of time given over to women's athletics, and it's also covered in qualitatively different and problematic ways, sexualizing the athletes, marginalizing them, infantilizing them in many ways.
And it seems like a self-fulfilling prophecy for the media giants, because you feel they say the fan base isn't there. But look at the New York Liberty women's basketball team. They've been around for, 20 years now?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah,
they don't have a huge...
WNBA is 20 years.
Yeah, they don't have a huge fan base. But now they don't get the proper coverage in terms of prime time, in terms of being on NBC, ABC, or CBS. But does one impact the other? But if they actually gave them a, say, 8 o'clock slot or whatever time the NBA is typically on, would that fan base grow and develop and work its way into the NBA sizable? Or is it always just the excuse that there is no fan base, and of course they'll keep it that way if they don't change things?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That excuse persists. When I wound up interviewing sports media executives for this book, I would ask them, how come you only cover 5% of the time women's athletics? And they would tell me, well, it's just there's not a fan base there. There's not a market. But there is a circular logic that you identify there, which is to say that there's not a fan base there because the resources, attention, marquee time slots are not given over to women's athletics. It's not hyped in the way that male athletics tends to be. And so that more or less sort of starves the content of an audience. And then in the absence of that audience, you can justify not giving the content the attention and hype that it might otherwise deserve. So, in an alternate universe, or maybe 10 years from now, hopefully not so long, there will be an equality of resources and attention given to both genders when it comes to sports coverage. But in the absence of that, I think it's really hard for the WNBA to ever draw the attention, audience, and revenues that the NBA does, because there's simply not the resources and structure put behind it.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I've been to a few games, and they are exciting. I find them to be, incredible players. The buzz is there. You can walk anywhere and get a good seat. But I would be totally into it. And as a matter of fact, I mean, the time is right. It's ironic when you think about this, but there's another football league starting. At the same time, when you think the NFL, can't consume enough or can't dominate the market enough, we have another splinter organization. What is it called? The X League?
Yeah, the XFL and
XFL.
I think the AAF or something like that. You're completely right. The one area of, I think, opportunity here, if I'm being optimistic and hopeful, will be women's soccer. For two reasons. First off, I 4 years ago, just speaking as a sample size of one, I was absolutely glued to every single one of the Women's World Cup
matches. Phenomenal.
They're phenomenal. Again, this is subjective, but I happen to think that women's soccer is far more interesting to watch than men's because there's far less flopping.
Define flopping.
There's less flopping, I find, in women's soccer.
What do you mean by flopping, Michael? I'm sorry.
By that I mean taking a very dramatic dive in order to draw a penalty.
Oh, I see.
But again, that's just sort of my opinion. But I think that women's soccer has the opportunity to move more to the forefront for two reasons. One, soccer in general, if sports were stocks, I would say soccer is a buy stock. Just in terms of millennial popularity, it being a globalized sport in an always increasingly internationalized sort of marketplace, and also there's some theories that soccer has not been gendered male within the U.S.
Correct.
In the same way that basketball, because it has such dominance and such lead time, it has been more or less gendered as a male sport. Soccer, because it has not been one of the top three or four sports in terms of American attention and popularity.
Like a cousin sport, a little distance.
Exactly, and it has the potential, therefore, to open up for more audiences to accept it as a female sport and embrace it.
But it's so interesting at the same time. I was just telling my colleagues here right before we started that I'm coaching two teams, and it's soccer teams, and the season's starting to ramp up. And when you go into the field every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I mean, they are packed across America playing soccer.
Yeah.
It's sad how things don't transition.
Yeah. And you know, it's an open question as to why it is that as you described correctly, there is such youth participation popularity. It's still an open question as to why it hasn't quite made that leap to break through to the top three or four popular American team sports. But I think it's right there, and I do think 10 years from now, it will be even more in that kind of centerpiece of spectacle.
And Michael Sorazio, I'm not sure if you're a parent, but obviously you're well-informed in terms about what parents do. And this is kind of a lower down the ladder aspect or perspective in terms of where sports start for individuals and their passion and how much money they will ultimately shell out, because they're instilled at a very young age. Look at all these specific training camps, these hardcore specialty sports facilities that take their kid and take your money, 5, 10, 15, 20 grand a year to make Johnny or Susie a better baseball player, batter, fielder, etc. And of course, you know, most of them don't go on to do anything close to playing baseball. It's a numbers game. But that's where it gets instilled. I mean, this all-in-or-nothing attitude just boggles my mind right now.
Yeah, it is. And you're absolutely right. What you describe is more or less the professionalization of youth amateur sports. There is money to be made, as you point out, right? There's a market for those parents who are eager to, you know, sort of dream big for their you know, daughter or son. And there is it is definitely something that has corrupted, I think, the integrity and the sort of pure joy of sport.
Exactly.
And it's been ongoing for a number of years now. I mean, I think it is. You know, persistent, but it is something that has been problematic for a number of years.
I have to laugh, and you'll probably appreciate this, Michael, is that, you know, I see people out, oh, yo, is so-and-so playing? Are your kids playing? Oh, are your kids playing travel? It's like, no, they're doing rec. Oh, yeah, our kids are doing travel, and we're doing this and that. I'm like, yeah. This league I'm in with is just so incredible, and it really depicts how, you know, how community is so vital, and that's why I love doing this. As a matter of fact, I'm even probably going to be a board member because I see the impact on kids. I have kids who are disabled. I have kids with no confidence, and give me 2 or 3 months, I turn them around. So, I mean, you know, they're feeling more confident. They're talking to people. They're working out in terms of, you know, despite their disability, and you can see, you know, not everyone wants to be a professional athlete, not even a top, you know, amateur athlete. It's just a rite of passage.
Yeah, completely. And what you describe in terms of that experience of the athletes that you work with and the sort of betterment of themselves is in many ways the sort of religious function of sports.
Absolutely.
Sports provides people with the same thing that they used to get, and some still do, get from religious context. It provides people meaning. It provides people a path to transcend where they are right now. It offers a sort of tribal identity. There are so many ways in which you can look at sports, especially nowadays in American culture, and you can see the outlines of religious experience and religious ritual and sort of internal religious movement.
Absolutely. And it's great. I mean, you can throw in accountability. You can throw in so many different adjectives and important factors for youth, and they don't have to play in high school. But I think it's a good fundamental stepping stone. And also, it's a good way to have perspective when you get older in terms of professional athletes, et cetera. And I want to get to one more thing, Michael Sorazio, before we let you go. The Power of Sports, Media, and Spectacle in America Culture. Phenomenal book. One thing that obviously could not be in that book, because this is a hot scandal that came out after your book hit the shelves, Robert Kraft.
Yeah.
All right. So if he takes the plea deal, he's got to plead guilty. That means Goodell, will have to sanction him harder. How do you think this is going to play out?
Yeah, I mean, it's all It's obviously all speculation at this point.
Sure.
So stipulating that first and foremost, and I suspect there are probably a few insiders, who have more insight than me on this point. I would suspect that there, all of my reading of the reporting on the relationship between Goodell and Kraft suggests that there's not a lot of love lost there. It seems as though Kraft has been and may or may not continue to be one of the most powerful and influential owners within the sort of NFL caste system. And so I think that there will have to be some sort of punishment. I've heard, just the reports, 4 games, 6 games, what have you. And I think that they'll have Goodell, for PR purposes, will feel compelled to come down on him in that way. But the real question for me will be, how influential will Kraft continue to be in terms of NFL power? The formality of the suspension will be for show. But the real question will be behind the scenes, will he no longer be one of the, say, top 3 or 4 most influential NFL leaders and owners? That, to me, will be the real interesting question, whether he's, whether he's lost influence in the eyes of the other 30 or so billionaires who sort of guide the spectacle.
And, Michael, I think for myself and many, many viewers, probably hundreds of thousands, this is just a message that proves once again how impenetrable the NFL is.
Yeah, completely.
Time after time.
It's a juggernaut. Yeah. Yeah, it remains a juggernaut. I think that this is, as you say, an example of how it remains sort of powerful and unstoppable.
Has your love or passion of covering sports, being part of sports, being a basic fan of sports changed in the last 5 or 7 years due to all the controversy?
Yeah, but mine is very specific. A very specific reason for that. So I mentioned at the beginning, I'm a native San Diegan.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up an absolute diehard San Diego Chargers fan. It was an heirloom that was passed down throughout my family. It was a source of bonding between my grandfather and I. And so when the franchise picked up and the specific ownership picked up and skipped town to LA 2 years ago, that was definitely I hear a lot of times sort of the Brooklyn Dodgers fans sort of commiserating about that from half a century ago, and there are far fewer of us San Diego Chargers fans than there were Brooklyn Dodgers fans, and for that matter, there seems like a ton of Brooklyn Dodgers fans who are like literati and like sort of prominent academic types, and so there's far few of us, but nonetheless, I feel as though that was very much moment where really you kind of lost some innocence about just what we love our teams. They don't really love us back. They just get money from us.
No. It's all about the dollars. The power of sports media and spectacle in America culture. Michael Serrazio, incredible job. This book is absolutely gorgeous. As a matter of fact, I'm probably going to have to buy a few copies because I can't keep this one still. Everyone in the office wants to read it. Well done, well done. And I wish you continued success in everything that you do. And the honesty of reporting should always be front and center. And that's obviously pivotal to you and one of your tenets.
Thank you very much, Mark. I really appreciate your time. I appreciate the chance to talk to you today.
Enjoy, Michael. Take care now.
Thank you very much. Take care.
It's Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Michael Serrazio is my guest. The Power of Sports, a phenomenal book. If you're into sports, if you're into the changing of the guard of sports, you're into the proliferation of the NFL and big media and money and how the players are just consuming, all-consuming, and in terms of how impenetrable sports are in America, pick it up, certainly by all means. Now, my next guest, Kirsten Corley, is an amazing person. She has committed her life to helping others, and she's on the phone right now, and she joins me from New Jersey, and she's part of Covenant House, and I want to have Kirsten on because she's talking about something very close to her heart and a change that's vital for all Americans, reducing homelessness. Kirsten, how are you doing, and welcome to the show, my friend.
Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, thank you for being here, and thank you for being willing to put aside your normal creature comforts to sleep on the streets of Newark in a sleeping bag and maybe a very, very comfortable cardboard box to show and to prove to others how paramount the homelessness epidemic is and to make a change about this.
Yes, so we have the Young Professional Sleep Out Movement happening in Newark tomorrow, actually. And myself and almost 100 other young professionals will come to the shelter, get to meet our kids, and in an act of solidarity, you know, sleep on the streets with a box and a sleeping bag and, you know, raise as much money as we can to do that. So it's taking place tomorrow in Newark. And I'm really excited. And, you know, we've been gearing up for this for a few months now, and it's just, it's a wonderful organization that helps homeless and trafficked youth just transition into a life where they can provide for themselves and have the fundamentals to lead a successful life.
Just for our listeners to be clear, we're talking about Newark, N-E-W-A-R-K, New Jersey. It's a urban town about 20 miles east of New York City. And what is the homelessness rate there, Kirsten?
Right now, we will serve 11,000 youth every single year. Today, 196 youth woke up in a Coven House, New Jersey bed. We are in 7 different areas located throughout the state. But nationwide, we are in 6 different countries, 31 different cities, serving 89,000 youth throughout the world.
How much press and coverage does your event of this caliber have, and what is the impact, do you think?
I hope people we get as much publicity and information out there. You know, we try and get as many young people, as many young professionals to these events, and it's taking place in LA, it's taking place in New York, it's taking place in Jersey, and, you know, it's all about connecting individuals to the cause so then they can become their own advocates and they can tell more people. So, you know, it's all about the individual coming in, learning about our kids, learning about the work we do, learning and getting to meet our staff. And it's what they do from there to carry on our mission and the work that we get to do every single day.
Kirsten Corley, this isn't your first sleep out. What is it like in the wee hours of the night when you're there? And of course, you know, it's only for a few hours, but still, your mind must go to a place where it rarely goes to in terms of, actually not for you. I take that statement back, because you think about others quite often, and you think about how you, yourself, and Covenant House can change, positively impact people's lives. But tell me about those thoughts, that, because those are like inner thoughts and thoughts of significance that really have, I'm sure, major outcomes for yourself and other people in the middle of the night.
Yes, and you know, that's definitely one of the challenges that sleepers have, that our kids face every single day. You know, our kids end up on the streets, and they're not only, you know, dealing with the mental things along with being lonely and hearing noises and the trucks that drive by, but then they're trying to get a night's sleep without the fear of, you know, someone's going to take the things I have left if I fall asleep. You know, I have to wake up for a job interview tomorrow. I have to look presentable for class. I have an exam. So, you know, there's a lot of mental difficulties that our kids have to deal with every single day. And, you know, we deal with it for one night. I get to go home to my bed afterwards, but this is a very real problem for our kids. And, you know, the mental challenges along with, you know, everything else that comes with being homeless is definitely relevant.
And I thank you for putting this front and center, because, you know, we think of people being homeless as just people who just want to drop out of society, don't want to exist on the radar. But it's far from true, because a lot of individuals, whether youth or adults, have mental health issues. That's what you were pointing out. And those are very, very real. Walk around Newark, New Jersey, or New York City here where we're broadcasting from, and you can see it's quite evident when you try to help people or speak to people, their reaction or how they may react. Or you see people walking down the street, and I'm not trying to certainly make fun of them, but it's reality. They need health care. They need professional help. And also, another reality is that how many of our listeners right here, how many millions of people across the country, all over the world, are a few paychecks away from being homeless? Go without paying your mortgage, you know, 6 months. Things get shut off, electric bill, cable. Forget about cable, all the luxuries of life. But the reality is, you know, we all aren't that far off from being homeless. And it's an epidemic, and it's something that can easily be changed. Of course, it's very political. People don't want homeless shelters. People don't want certain organizations in their backyard. But, you know, things won't change without proper course of action when the existence of Covenant House, which is how many years old, Covenant House?
In New Jersey, we've been around since 1986.
86. And New York City, way longer than that. Doing phenomenal work. This is just one of a multitude of programs that are serving the community to prevent youth from having to grow up in the city of Newark without a home and shelter.
Yeah, I mean, it takes so much courage for our kids to even walk through the doors and admit, hey, I need help. Hey, I need some food. Hey, I need some clothes. Hey, I don't have a place to sleep. So, you know, more than anything, it's our kids that are brave and courageous and have so much strength within them and want to change their lives. So they find us and, you know, together we hopefully end up with a success story and, you know, the kids end up being able to either have a job or an education and
a fair chance
in a way, security in a way they've never had before.
And unfortunately, though, the reality is they're just essentially a victim of circumstance. You know, they're in a maybe they were in a situation where their parents walked out. They don't have a single parent. Maybe there's drugs involved and they chose to leave because being on the streets is better than living in a drug den. I mean, there's a multitude of reasons why this happens, but it's not because most of the time someone chooses, especially a youth, to live on the streets in the cold, in the hot, going to bed hungry, waking hungry. And I said bed. There's no bed. There's a surface, a safe surface, trying to survive because it's certainly not only not uncomfortable living on a street, it's far from safe.
Yeah, and that's one of the hardest things too that people grasp is, you know, when it's safer to leave the house that they consider home and it's safer to be on the streets than it is who's ever in that house. It's safer to be away from some of the environments they've grown up with. And, you know, it's to their no fault of their own, you know, everyone gets dealt different cards. And, you know, it's these kids making this choice to change their lives and change the circumstances. You know, it's some kids fall through the foster care system. Some people lose a parent. Some people's parents lose their jobs and they don't know what to do. Some just have too many kids and, you know, they're the oldest and they can't afford to have the kids in the house. So it's all different circumstances. Some are, unfortunately, victims of sex trafficking, which is a very real problem here in America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's very real issues and it's very real things that these kids deal with.
And you're doing very, very real work. The Covenant House has just incredible opportunities from social workers on staff, lawyers, nurses, anything the kids need. Help is there. Doors are open. And an event like this, Sleep Out, as a matter of fact, the website is sleepout.org, sleepout.org. Whether you're living in the Tri-State area or out on the West Coast or wherever you do live abroad, feel free to reach out to Covenant House. Feel free to get out, to get involved and learn more about homelessness. Maybe there's someone in your community. Maybe the head of the show was talking about, Kirsten, before you came on, that I worked at a shelter one night about 15 years ago where I slept over, fed them dinner and fed them breakfast the night the next morning. And it's an eye-opening experience. And you will realize that they are sometimes a victim of circumstance. Not everyone chooses, by all means, to live on the streets. Everyone wants just to be loved and be safe, happy, and healthy. I mean, it's not a tall order in this lifetime, in this world, with what we have at our disposal. But unfortunately, we have to go about it the hard way. It's political.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many different layers to it. But with the aspect of an existence of Covenant House doing such unbelievable work, you know, I take off my hat to you and Covenant House.
Thank you very much. And, you know, we're always looking for ways for people to get involved. We have a Women's Unite edition Sleep Out coming up April 26th. We have an Asbury Park edition coming up in May. And, you know, I'm always looking for young professional volunteers. We're always looking for companies to get involved. So at any capacity, if you're interested in learning more, you know, reach out to me, reach out to somebody here at Covenant House, New Jersey, and, you know, we'll make this a part of your life as it has been a part of mine.
Well, I am interested in taking part in the Asbury Park, New Jersey Sleep Out, so count me in.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing you there. Thank
Kirsten
you so
Corley,
much.
Before I let you go, it's all about money. We need money to keep Covenant House open. We need money to buy sleeping bags. We need money to feed and educate and help professionals create resumes for the youth and individuals that are homeless. Sleepout.org. Sleepout.org. Is that where they can donate as well?
Yeah. So if you go, sleepout.org, and you know, make sure you look at the Jersey Sleep Out, and that's where you can support us tomorrow and where we'll be tomorrow in Newark is for the New Jersey Young Professional Sleep Out.
Thank you, Kirsten Corwood, for all you do. You're a pretty amazing person. And also, you did a half marathon last weekend, correct?
I did, yes.
How are you feeling, girlfriend?
Half marathon. I'm doing good. Doing good. Looking forward to the next one.
Good. Another day, another type of marathon. Tomorrow, it's at the Covenant House on the streets of Newark. Great job. Keep up the good work, Kirsten.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
Have a good day. My name is Mark Farrell. This has been Insight. Thank you so much to our guest, Michael Serrazio. Great, phenomenal book that he wrote, The Power of Sports, Media, and Spectacle in American Culture. Thanks to Kirsten Corley, who's doing amazing work with Covenant House and for the youth in New Jersey, especially in Newark, New Jersey. Love to have your questions, emails, etc. at mark@markfarrellmotivation.com. mark@markfarrellmotivation.com. Thanks to all the fine folks here at the Progressive Radio Network. And thanks to you for listening now, to Gary Noll, to everyone here at PRN. Have a great day.
Check out this and all Insight shows on the Insight page at PRN.FM. PRN.FM. Have Mark speak at your company, your kid's school or college. Mark speaks on critical topics that affect kids and adults everywhere, from anti-bullying, mental health, drugs, and alcohol, to overcoming adversity. Visit MarkFarrellMotivation.com for more info. Insight, Thursday mornings at 11 on the Progressive Radio Network.
PRN station manager. I have an exciting announcement for our amazing listeners. PRN has a new voicemail line that will allow you to connect better with our host. If you